This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Five Cincinnati City Council members are told by a judge they should resign. What's next after the so-called Gang of Five and their text messages are called out in a court of law? Plus, the Covington Catholic incident at the Lincoln Memorial inspired new legislation in Frankfurt. We'll take a look at the anti-doxing bill. Kentucky teachers closed their districts to protest the General Assembly's plans. And the gorilla Ndume is coming back to Cincinnati. We'll have the latest on that coming up in our Friday news review. But first, let's talk text messages. Joining me in the studio, our Cincinnati Inquirer reporter, Sherry Coolidge. Welcome back, Sherry.
Hello.
Business career reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you.
And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay.
Hi there.
If you've got questions about the Gang of Five, this Gang of Three is standing by. Call
513-419-7100
or email talk at WVXU.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll look for your comments and your tweets.
We can't take text. It would be appropriate.
I'll text you after the show.
I feel like we just got a nickname that people can actually say out loud. God only knows what they say behind our backs. Oh, wait. We saw some of that.
So the last time I had all of you on, I think we were talking about a soccer stadium, and I was concerned because I was afraid we were going to have like soccer stadium fatigue. Now today, I kind of wish we were talking about a soccer stadium because this has been like an exhausting story. It looks like we're finally at the end or near the end of the so-called Gang of Five text message scandal. Five Cincinnati City Council members hauled into court on Thursday. Jay, let's just start with what happened yesterday.
Well, we talked about it briefly on the air yesterday. To me, it was kind of a little bit strange because I was expecting this hearing to go on for an hour, maybe even more than an hour, maybe 2 hours. And it lasted all of 16 minutes. And we thought there would be some theatrics where he would actually make the Gang of Five stand, the judge would make the Gang of Five stand in front of him so he could scold them. And he didn't do that. He, you know, asked a couple of questions, read a statement. They sat in the audience the whole time and court was adjourned. And again, I mean, I think it was a little bit surprising that he actually, you know, called for them to resign.
I mean, boy, did he read a statement though, right?
I guess
this is Judge Robert Ruhlman, we should say.
Yeah, it just seemed, like I said, we thought there would be, you know, this was a chance to make a little bit of a show to have them basically stand in front of the teacher and take your licks. And that didn't happen.
But you, I mean, still, the judge said, you know, you essentially lied to the people of the city. It's going to take a long time to get that trust back. And then he called for them to resign and said, no city voter should ever vote for them again.
So that was a pretty
stunning,
strong statement. First, you have the unusual scene of more than half of the city council hauled into court. Now, while they didn't have to stand before the judge, they were in the gallery. They were sitting there.
To see them in the courtroom at all.
Exactly.
Was a stunning moment in our city history, I think.
So what was the reaction immediately after the judge had to say that? Did the council members have anything to say? I know that they said things later on social media.
I was going to say, as soon as he said adjourned, they took off.
Except Greg Landsman. Landsman stood and made comments to us, yeah.
Well, he's apologized even before this. Yeah. He said, I'm taking responsibility. You know, and later through the day, we would hear that more from P.G. Sittenfeld and Chris Seelbach as the day kind of went on. Wendell has, you know, he's not done. And so his attorney's like, he won't be talking.
Which makes sense.
So.
But the attorney said some interesting things.
Yes, he did. And I think that's the second part of this.
Oh, okay.
No, that's okay. So
we'll come back to it.
I do want
to
get into how the various city council members responded to this because they all had different variations of how to approach this at first. We're going to dive into that in just a bit. But first, let's just remind everyone that this all started with some text messages between five members of city council as they were discussing. I guess it all started with the talk about the former city manager. And because five members constitute a quorum among the Cincinnati City Council, it was determined by a judge previously that the text violated what we know as sunshine laws. So now that we know all that was said, because we saw the text messages between all five before, but now we're seeing text messages between various combinations of those five. Which messages stood out to each of you? I want to give you the opportunity to respond to that.
Well, you know, for us at the Business Courier, we were curious about any interactions they had with the corporate community, anything they said about any of them. The one that we ended up leading with, and we wrote about some other ones too that the Inquirer and everyone else wrote about as well, but the one that we wrote about was a statement by Chris Seelbach that Jim McGraw, who is a very influential CEO of KMK Consulting, which is kind of a government affairs firm in town, and they do a lot of development work, and they try to bring business to the city, and they represent clients and whatnot. They basically said Jim McGraw controls economic development in the city. And it wasn't exactly clear where Seelbach had heard that, but he had heard it in the course of the Harry Black thing that went on. And of course, Harry Black made some accusations about the mayor when it comes to economic development. So that was very interesting to us. We called Mr. McGraw, and of course, he said, I wish I was powerful enough to control all of the economic development in the city. I don't really know what to say. I've always acted ethically and transparently and in good faith. So, you know, that was kind of the one that we led with.
And that text referenced Harry Black and the FBI.
Correct. Yeah. Seelbach at one point had said, you know, I've heard that that Harry has enough for the FBI to, quote unquote, I think, take a look. We've never, you know, obviously gotten confirmation that the FBI ever looked at any of this situation, any of the allegations that Mr. Black made against the mayor. So that is where it is.
And Sherry, which one stood out to you?
You know, we, taken as a whole, there's a lot of divisiveness. That's really the big takeaway for us. But we led with, you know, something that Vice Mayor Smitherman has been talking about for a long time turned out really to be in there. And so we led with that, which was, you know, where P.G. Sittenfeld and Chris Seelbach were discussing a radio appearance by Christopher Smitherman, and there's definitely some underlying politics there, but they brought up, you know, his very ill wife and that, you know, Christopher was very, very upset about that. And, like, so we did that with, like, a deep dive into, like, not just, oh, they said this, but it's, like, the context of it, how it started, where it came from, and what everybody was thinking as, you know, the 2021 mayor's race is coming apparently sooner than 2021. I don't know.
I think it started on November, whatever the day after the election in 2017 did. I mean, that's been clear for several years.
Did anything
years
stand now out to you, Jay?
I think, and we divided, they came out in 626 pages, I think it was. It was 600 plus pages. We divided it among six people in the newsroom. So I only read like 100 pages of them. I guess what, and we were, as we were talking, I was just looking for a bombshell that we hadn't had an inkling, because I had a pretty good idea of what some of the bombshells were going to be and that would be in there. And it's like, okay, let's see if those were right, that the bombshells that I knew about could be in there. Or was there just one bombshell that nobody wanted to admit to and it was going to be in there? And it's like, oh, wow, this is even worse. And I don't think that was most of the thing. There was one thing that I was told that was in there that was not. Everything else I had sort of been led to believe was there.
Was that the N-word text?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we should talk about that. I mean, there had been rumors, and the vice mayor had said on talk radio that there potentially—
Repeatedly,
yeah, had said, oh, you know, there's a text where one member of council uses the N-word. And, you know, thank God for the Finney Law Firm putting these up on their website in a searchable format, because we were able to, you know, search for that word or variations of it, and it just wasn't there.
Interesting. So what is this going to do to relationships on council? I'm curious about if there's any feelings among the members, whether they need to rebuild anything, particularly Chris Smitherman, who was not part of the Gang of Five, and P.G. Sittenfeld, who is part of the Gang of Five, and they look like they may be on a collision course for a mayoral race in a couple of years. What do they need to do?
There's going to be so many hurt feelings. I already know that there are some. You know, the mayor came into editorial board at the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he talked about ones we had already seen in which his feelings were hurt, and there's more of the same. They say terrible things about him, and like name-calling kind of things, and, you know— He says, you know, I'm not immune to that. But then there's other things. You know, there's terrible things said about Jeff Pastor. There's something terrible in here said about Amy Murray. I don't think any human can walk in there on Monday and sit down for budget committee and be like, how's everybody doing today? And shake some hands and, you know, then talk about some city business without thinking, you know, one time when we were in here, somebody was thinking this and somebody was thinking that and somebody said this. There's hurt feelings. And that doesn't heal overnight, I don't think.
I also I completely agree with that. But I also think that much of this was not a surprise to them. I mean, people weren't on the radio jawboning about what could be in this and not knowing or not having some ideas about what it was. So I think this has been festering for a while, and it's a scab that's going to continue to be there.
And the Sittenfeld Smitherman thing, I think that is what it is. They're going to be opponents probably in 2021. And, you know, I don't see that changing. But there are probably some things that, again, if you'd know these messages were going to be made public, you might not have said, but, you know.
I thought Jason Williams did a great job today kind of framing this in terms of the mayor's race. And I think the interesting thing to think about as we think about Smitherman and Sittenfeld in the mayor's race is, will some enterprising politician in this town look at this and say, this is an opportunity for me to run for mayor and be the voice of reason and the voice of, you know, I'm bringing sanity back to City Hall. That was kind of how Mark Mallory ran the first time in 2005. He was an outsider from the state capitol. And he had never been at City Hall, and that was kind of the platform he had run on. It's probably an opportunity for someone to do the same thing right
now.
But,
you know, we do have, you know, 3 more years, basically. And so I was thinking about, everybody said yesterday that they do want to put this behind everybody and, like, move forward and do some good things for the city. And I was like, what are those things? And let's get going. Because we definitely, this has dominated the first year of council like no one's business. I did the search for, I was looking for a story in the archives, and I could not even believe the number of stories I wrote about this. And I kind of waned and stopped writing about it as it was rolling along because it was getting to be too much. And this marks the first year, and it's like, what's going to happen with the second year? I mean, we saw some stuff with the streetcar this week that isn't the outcome that we wanted for the streetcar. And we have an almost $19 million deficit. That doesn't leave you a lot of money to do these big, great things that these people are talking about that they want to do. So I don't, like, they could put it behind them, but they're going to actually have to do things that overshadow this.
So we're up against a break, and I know Chris can't stick around on the other side of that break. So before I let you go, we're talking a little bit about the political aftermath, but there was sort of a political preview leading up to this. According to, I guess, your own column, you suggested that the court system had even been weaponized because of the politics of this. Can you explain that to
Just
us?
Just to explain that, it's a pretty in-depth thing to try to go through, but basically, I talked to Brian Shrive and Chris Finney in the weeks leading up to this, and actually, at the hearing in November over AFTAB Pureval, and they kind of explained their business model, which is, we are going to try to help politically, you know, political campaigns or whatever, what have you, by providing a legal component to it. And I think that they executed that strategy perfectly in this case. And Judge Ruhlman went overboard in allowing them to do so, because there's a whole quite – these text messages that we're seeing, they're the only ones we're going to see, the one-on-ones. We're not going to see one-on-ones between –
until the Inquirer wins its lawsuit, and then ones about business will become the public records that they actually are. But these ones do include personal texts, and even the Inquirer agrees, personal texts. PG and Chris Seelbacher are friends. Their personal texts are not really the citizen's business, but there is a lot of business stuff in here.
There sure is.
And, you know, and they were all along, like, these are our personal texts. No, there's tons of business. There's tons of business between 4 members of council.
But the city's position is that is not public record today. And
the Inquirer's position is otherwise.
My position is that, but we'll see. And it's interesting that Brian Shrive did not want to pursue that in the appellate court. Maybe it's a legal fee thing. Maybe he doesn't think he's going to win. Who knows? But it is what it is. And I thought that was an overreach by the judge.
513-419-7100 if you want to weigh in. The Cincinnati streetcar has a new leader at City Hall, but questions have arisen around the choice. Chris Wederick has to take off, but Jay and Sherry are sticking around to discuss more on that. And we'll have other headlines from the week as our Friday news review continues. After this short break, this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Kentucky General Assembly is approaching its final days in Frankfurt. We'll take a look at the latest legislation, including some that has a teacher has many teachers upset and an anti-doxing bill inspired by the Covington Catholic Lincoln Memorial incident. That's just ahead. But first, we continue our conversation about Cincinnati City Hall with WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sherry Coolidge. 513-419-7100. If you'd like to weigh in, talk at WVXU.org is our email, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We got a comment from Steve. He would like to know your thoughts on how yesterday's court appearance compares to all of the other council drama that has taken place. He cites Blackwell, FCC, Streetcar. How would you say this compares from a drama rating overall?
It's like he's reading my mind.
I would say it would rank pretty high.
It's number one. It's a court hearing. It's just not, you know, City Hall. It's they had to come over to a court. They were called by a judge to come over to the courthouse. Pretty serious.
Okay.
Although I guess I could make a somewhat of an argument that the Streetcar is a drama in and of itself, and that it's the drama gift that just keeps on giving, because it was, you know, do we do it? Do we not do it? Do we continue with it? Do we stop it? And the people that turned out for that and the issues that I don't know. For drama wise, I'd still have to say the Streetcar ranks
and
at the top.
We're going to touch on that.
But we're allowed to disagree.
We're going to talk about the Streetcar as well.
Maybe we should do a Twitter poll.
I do want to talk a little bit about Twitter now that you mention it, because looking at the responses on Twitter from both the members of council and the public, I'm seeing quite a variety in the types of responses that we're seeing. First, what has the general response been overall from just the public reading these stories?
So if you're talking about Twitter, it's definitely very mixed, but I feel like those are a lot of the same voices. The thing that has surprised me about this one is the real reader response. You know, I've said on here before that typically the real reader response is about litter, sewer bills, water. And I have a lot of people I've never heard from today on this issue weighing in. And they're disappointed. Nobody's like, the judge is right, they should resign. But people are expressing disappointment in some emails to me.
And again, remind us, we got a comment from Jean. She wants us to clarify who the Gang of Five is. So let's just rattle off those names.
Tamiya Denard, Chris Seelbach, P.G. Sittenfeld, Wendell Young, and Greg Landsman.
Okay.
Those names kind of like float in front of my face sometimes.
Democrats.
The word Gang of Five did in text we originally saw, because they were in group texts that were released earlier. Wendell Young refers to each of them as the new Gang of Five. And that is where that term kind of took off in a slangy way, for sure.
But yeah, it wasn't a media creation. It was something created by the Gang of Five.
And before we get too far along and overlook this, we do want to mention that Wendell Young has to go back to court on April the 1st.
Because he's accused of getting rid of some evidence?
There's an allegation that he deleted, Judge Ruhlman had issued an order that they were to preserve the text. And there's an allegation that after he issued that order, Councilmember Young deleted text off of his phones, disobeying that court order. So that could be a contempt of court charge. And so that's going to be heard on.
His attorney says in no way did he do this counter to what the judge said. I think that I want to be, because that's the first time we ever heard that. But the settlement does include a city admission that he did delete his text. I'm like,
but and a $10,000 fine.
Is he guilty? Is he not guilty? Prosecutor, like, there's a million questions left there on this one.
And even there was some, I mean, his attorney said yesterday in open court that he, the attorney, Scott Croswell, had talked to the prosecutor's office Thursday morning, and they assured him that no text had been deleted after the judge's order. And then we got a statement from the prosecutor's office in the afternoon that seemed to walk that back a little bit.
So let's go over the reactions from the members of counsel who faced the judge, or maybe they didn't necessarily stand up and face them, but watched from the gallery. Chris Seelbach took aim at the judge originally. A tweet from him suggested that Ruhlsman is one of the most overturned judges in Southwest Ohio who had criticized rape victims, that the Inquirer once wrote that Ruhlsman should retire. So he started off defiant, it looks like, in his response, and then it cooled over the course of the day, and he ultimately apologized as well.
You know, this is something I heard from all of them all along. So he may have said it on Twitter, but, you know, they felt like this was a big overreach from the judge, and it probably was, but he's still the judge, and the facts are still the facts. So he did do that, but he's, you know, this judge is known for being unpredictable.
One of the responses from Councilwoman Tamiya Denard indicated that she did not get rid of any text messages. So she had been accused of doing this as well. What's the story here?
I won't say that she was accused of deleting text messages. There was the story going around in the media that somewhere along the way this summer, her phone had got dropped in a swimming pool, and some of the texts were not retrievable, which turned out not to be the case. I think she dropped her phone at a pool and it maybe got water damage, but it was not dropped in the pool. And anything that they sought to get off of her phone was fully retrieved, from what I understand.
That seemed to be what she said in her statement, was that she had already turned over all of the data, and that while her phone did suffer some water damage at some point, it wasn't some lie or some attempt to, I guess, drown the phone so that something wouldn't be traceable.
I mean, we certainly didn't say that.
And I think her tweets, she had several tweets, and I don't have them. I know she said lots of things in her tweets, but I think it was that she had turned it over and she thought that they were done with it. And it turned out that they weren't able, they didn't do what they were supposed to be able to do. And then they had to come along and do it again. And that was after this incident where it was dropped.
Okay. What about P.G. Sittenfeld? He's got a lot at stake here politically. If he's looking at a mayoral campaign and a lot of unflattering coverage right now of this situation, how has he responded?
I think it was like a two-part. Well, actually, I have his statement with me.
You know, his original statement was wide-sweeping and seemed very planned. But I talked to him later, and say what the statement says, and I'll talk about a conversation.
He said, first, having a quorum participating on one thread was an honest mistake for which I've apologized and which won't happen again. And the second thing, I'll reiterate that the content of my own text are more of the same of what's previously been released. There are things I certainly would have said more artfully, but I am a human being, and the voters have always known they were electing a real person, a flesh and blood human being.
So that's a statement. Now that's in the story, but people were really calling for them to do what Greg did, which is apologize immediately. And so we're having a conversation. Jason and I were on speakerphone, like at our desks, because we sit right next to each other.
You're talking about Jason Williams at
yes.
the Inquirer.
And, you know, he seemed really sorry. Like, he was saying that, and he really seemed to mean it. And he felt bad for that his words were hurting people's feelings, and that he actually had done that, and it had gotten a little bit out of hand. And he promised to do better. And I felt like he was very sincere.
Okay, we've got a phone call from Ken. What's your question or comment, Ken?
Well, hey, I guess I'd say in the age of Trump, does anybody really care? Because he said far worse. I think the only people that really care about this in Cincinnati are the Inquirer reporters. So, just my thoughts.
Okay, Ken, thanks for your call. I guess his statement is that the president has said more rude things.
Absolutely.
Than
I do think people care about that, though, you know, and you can see it both ways. And I think that's happening here. There's certainly people who are saying this amounts to nothing.
Yeah.
But we're just providing the facts. And, you know, you can choose to think that it doesn't matter, or you can look at it and say to yourself, you know, this is the side of these council members I have not known before. And I feel like when we're talking about candidates, especially ones that are going to be running again, like providing all of the context about them and everything you know about them is important. And this is something we have never seen before. And I certainly sympathize with the idea that their personal texts were among these. But even in the business ones, I thought they were very telling about how they feel about things and people. And, you know, so we're providing the information, and please definitely feel the way you want to feel about it.
And one thing that the public has expressed concern about is that this whole situation comes with a price tag. And we did get a comment from Christopher, who wants to know why taxpayers are footing a bill instead of the council members.
There is a city settlement fund. They're paying it out of that. Now
And how much is it?
It's $101,000. $90,000 of that goes to the attorney's fees for the plaintiff. $10,000 was a fine, I believe, that was assessed to Mr. Young for the possible deletion of the text, and then there was a $1,000 fine for the Gang of Five for violating the Sunshine Law. Now, there are reports that the Five are going to perhaps repay that part of the fine.
The $1,000.
So that would basically be $200 a council member.
Okay, so obviously the Gang of Five and the text messages were the big story out of City Hall, but we did have another story out of City Hall I want to get to before we run out of time today. We've got a new leader at the city for the streetcar?
We have an interim deputy director of the streetcar project.
Okay.
And it is Travis, I think I got his
right.
Jarek. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I got the right. It's Travis Jarek. He is an assistant city solicitor in the real estate division, and the city manager announced this week that he will be the deputy director of the interim deputy director of the streetcar. And when asked why interim, assistant city manager John Jewick basically said they're going to see how things go, and if it works out, then eventually the interim will be removed from his name.
This is extremely frustrating, and it has nothing to do with who this person is, because there's a lot said, like, give this person a chance, and I 100% agree with that. But, you know, this is going back to there's streetcar struggles, and they're just looking for one person to take ownership of this, and the idea was that it was going to be this hire, and it's been... And it would happen quickly, and we were going to have some fixes, and things were going to get better. And, you know, we went along. Where's the hire? People applied. And, you know, behind the scenes, who didn't like this person? Who didn't like that person? And it gets to a point, well, are we going to hire somebody? And the city manager's like, well, how about this guy? And is that stupid? Not, I think, what council members had in mind. And you know what it reminds me of? The traffic study. Also not what they had in mind, which is kind of like a vague, the traffic's not great downtown.
And Councilmember Seelbach, clearly there was another person who was interested in the job and didn't get it, because that's who Councilmember Seelbach said in the committee that he would have preferred this other person. They did not name this person, but I have speculation on who it is, but I'm not going to speculate. But there was someone that obviously, again, where you could have had a unanimous choice, perhaps. Again, when it comes to the streetcar, there's division.
Well, and, you know, his resume is as a fixer of very serious city problems, landslides, that kind of thing, and being able to fix some big problems that are complicated. But it is not transit experience, although, quite frankly, I think we know what the streetcar needs, like, and it doesn't take, like, a lot of transit experience to know that this thing, it needs to be free. I'm sorry.
Let's check out the phones. We have Jeff on the line. Jeff, what's your question or comment? Hey, Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, what's your question?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about the money, the taxpayer dollars being used to defend. I think, for me, that's the biggest part of this whole thing.
The money spent to defend the council members?
Yeah. You know, I think it's $101,000 used.
Well, that's
to
the settlement,
defend,
right?
Defend the five. These are taxpayer dollars going to defend people that, you know, were blatantly, you know, that even knew that what they were doing was wrong. So for me, that's the biggest part of this. And also on the streetcar, you know, we hired somebody, he's in real estate. Attorney, and I understand he's probably a pretty smart guy, but it's like needing a heart surgeon and asking a pediatrician to take his place. It doesn't make sense to me if it's a transportation department, it should be run by a transportation expert.
All right, Jeff, we appreciate your comment. And before I let you both go, we got a comment from Hans. And just very briefly, wants your thoughts on the Uptown Connector part of the streetcar, whether that has a chance still or if it's just a pipe dream.
I would say right now that's a pipe dream.
All right.
Affordability. I mean.
Well, thank you, Jay. Thank you, Sherry, for talking to us today. Always a pleasure to have you both in.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Medical marijuana, concealed carry, anti-doxing, and more, all part of bills that are making moves in Frankfurt. Let's discuss that now with Associated Press reporter Adam Beam, who joins us on the phone. Welcome back, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
If you've got questions or comments about the legislation in Frankfurt, give us a call at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We appreciate your time, Adam. Medical marijuana advanced this week. What's the status of the bill?
Well, we're at the point of the session now where any bill that has two readings technically can pass. But it's really late in the session. I think it has support in the House, probably enough support to pass, but the question is, does it have enough Republican support? Republicans control that chamber, and they don't like to pass things where their caucus is heavily divided. In other words, they don't want to have to pass something where it's like 30 Republicans and 30 Democrats vote for it. They want to be the Republicans want to be the one to pass it. So I'm not sure if they have the votes in the Republican caucus to bring it for a floor vote, but I'm pretty sure it would pass if it was called for a vote. But then you have to deal with the state Senate. And in the state Senate, the Senate president and the number two person there, the Senate majority floor leader, have both signaled their opposition to this. So I'm not sure. It's still possible for it to pass, but it appears unlikely.
So this is a piece of legislation co-sponsored by Northern Kentucky State Rep. Diane St. Onge. She's a Fort Wright Republican. And when the bill cleared the Judicial Committee this week, there were some changes to it. So if it becomes law, like, patients won't actually be able to smoke the marijuana or grow it. Why did those changes happen?
I think those changes were an attempt to get more support from Republicans in the House caucus so that they could call it for a vote. I think some Republicans, they're okay with the medical part of it. They hear these emotional testimony from people that really this is the only relief they have. But they're wary of legalizing something that you could smoke or, grow yourself because they're afraid it has the potential for abuse. So I think it was just an attempt to win over some of those votes.
So what does this leave us with if it becomes law? Patients will have access to medical marijuana edibles?
Right. Edibles, oils. There's various ways to ingest it besides smoking.
Okay, and I don't suppose you've done a whip count on the House of Representatives to know what it looks like, since you talked about the Republicans don't want to look too divided.
No, I haven't. I would say it's got a lot of support, but I don't think it's got enough yet.
Okay, so another Northern Kentucky connection to the General Assembly this week was the appearance of Ted Sandman, who spoke before a committee. He's the father of Covington Catholic student Nick Sandman, who became the student face of the now infamous incident at the Lincoln Memorial back in January. What is this so-called anti-doxing legislation?
It would make it a crime, specifically a misdemeanor, to dox someone. And doxing is a term that means you release a person's personal information in an effort to intimidate, harass, or frighten them. So in other words, you could post a picture of someone and their home address and say, go get this person. And specifically, it would make this a crime to do this to anyone who is under the age of 18. Now, opponents are worried about this. They're worried about it violating First Amendment free speech rights. And they also say, look, we already have laws on the books against terroristic threatening and things like that, so we don't really need this. But, the lawyer for Mr. Sandman and a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate think we do need this. And so it passed the Senate easily yesterday.
So now it's headed to the House?
It is.
Okay. So also approved recently, permitless concealed carry. What is that?
Basically, you could carry a weapon on your person hidden. So it could be in your pocket. It could be under your coat. And you wouldn't have to have a special permit to do that. Right now, you can carry a gun openly anywhere, but without a permit. But now you have to have a permit to carry it hidden. And it requires you to go pass a test. I think you have to pass like a written test and do like a shooting range to get a license for it. And this would allow you to do that without a permit or a license. And it's been a big push by the NRA and a lot of Republican and conservative-led states. They feel like, just infringes on their Second Amendment rights to have to jump through hoops to carry a weapon hidden. And, of course, the people that oppose this, of course, worry, and which include, I might add, most of the law enforcement agencies in the state oppose it because they feel like, look, it's dangerous. People need this training. And law enforcement, they don't want a bunch of people running around with guns and they can't see them.
On Thursday, Governor Matt Bevin spoke to an anti-abortion rally. He called himself the most pro-life governor in America. He said, quote, "There has never been such an individual born at any stage of gestation that has ever turned into a chicken or a fish or a cow. This is a human being. It's a human being from the beginning. It's a human being all the way to the end," end quote. What type of abortion decisions have been made in Frankfurt so far this session?
Well, their ultimate goal is to get a court case before the Supreme Court that would overturn Roe v. Wade. And I think their best chance of doing that is something called the Fetal Heartbeat Bill. And it would make it illegal to perform an abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected. I believe a fetal heartbeat can be detected as early as 6 weeks in pregnancy. So it would effectively ban all abortions after that time. And right now, I think Kentucky right now has a 20-week ban on abortions. And so this fetal heartbeat bill, I think it's been declared unconstitutional in other states. So really, I don't think Republican lawmakers, I think they're aware this is going to be challenged in court and likely struck down, but they want to get it before the state Supreme Court in order to try to overturn Roe v. Wade. Other examples of abortion bills they've passed include ones that prohibit abortions for reasons of because of the baby's race or gender or ethnicity.
So this is often a priority for Republicans, abortion, but does it seem like it's being heralded as more of an issue for that party this year, or are they just taking advantage of being fully in control of Frankfurt right now?
Well, it's an election year. We have statewide offices on the ballot, including the governor. And so, yeah, I think these social issues, Republicans know that social issues help them a lot. And that, you know, this is going to help the Republicans all over Kentucky on the statewide ticket this year.
So in terms of constitutional offices that will be on the ballot, Secretary of State is one of those positions. Allison Lundgren Grimes currently holds that office. She won't be able to run for another term, but there was some legislation aimed at her specifically this week. Can you give us the background on that?
Yeah, so the Lexington Herald Leader and ProPublica did a pretty thorough series on this, picking up on some allegations that have been made publicly against the Secretary of State's office by two employees, one current and one former, of the State Board of Elections. And they allege that the Secretary of State and her staff have misused their access to the voter registration database, that they've been using that database, looking up information on people for political purposes. And, of course, the Secretary of State's office denies this. And so this bill that's moving through the legislature would essentially strip the Secretary of State of her ability to have unfettered access to this database. She says that would be would prohibit her from being able to do her job as the state's chief elections officer. So there's a lot of politics at play here. And it appears dead at the moment. It died in the House. The House committee refused to pass it. But it has revived in the form of an amendment on another bill.
Oh, okay. So it has resurfaced. And I thought it was interesting in front of that committee, this bill died thanks to some help from Republicans.
That's right. Representative Jeff Hoover, former House Speaker, Republican, voted with the Democrats. And he said, look, I don't like voting on bills that I think have political motivations behind them. And he feels that there's some politics more than policy behind this bill.
So State Senator Damon Thayer, who's a Republican from Georgetown in Scott County, but also represents Grant County and part of Kenton County. So he's part of the Northern Kentucky Legislative Caucus. He wasn't happy with this decision by the panel. He was there in front of the panel as they voted, and he had some words for them. How do you describe that interaction?
Well, Senator Thayer is an intense guy. He's very passionate about his politics, and he let it be known that he was very upset, and he basically told them, this is on you, and if there's a problem with the election this year, it's on everybody that voted no. Of course, he said it in a very forceful way, and it kind of riled up everybody, and the chairman, Representative Kevin Bratcher from Louisville, had to step in and say, nope, we're not doing this, and kind of shut it down. So that's where it ended.
But then it kind of continued in the hall, I guess, with our buddy Daniel DeRochers from the Herald Leader. There was, I guess, a little exchange. No, excuse me. That was with the Grimes staff person.
Yeah, there was a staff member. I didn't witness this, but according to Daniel, Daniel went up to the Grimes staffer and asked for a comment, and the Grimes staffer replied with some version of, I only speak to real journalists, or actual journalists or something.
And of course, Daniel worked on the story that led
right.
to this legislation. Yeah, so that was a pretty tense day for, I guess, both sides of the aisle in Frankfurt.
That's right.
So Governor Bevin also didn't get exactly what he wanted for, I'm trying to understand this, repairs to Kentucky State Parks?
That's right. He wanted to borrow about $50 million in the 2019-2020 budget year to fix up the state park system. This is on top of the $38 million the legislature has already appropriated to the state parks since 2016. And the House gave it to him, and the Senate said no. And interestingly, the Senate includes Ralph Alvarado, who was Matt Bevin's running mate. And Ralph, of course, voted to strip the money out.
Wow.
He said later that he was just trying to get it to a conference committee, that he actually does support the money. So that bill is going to a conference committee, and Republican legislators are going to have to work it out.
All right, Adam, we appreciate your time today and helping us understand all that legislation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So some other legislation has Kentucky teachers so upset that some districts have closed multiple times this week. Let's get the latest from Louisville Courier-Journal reporter Mandy McLaren. Mandy, welcome.
Hi, Michael. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. This week, every Northern Kentucky superintendent spoke out against a bill in the House of Representatives. It seems that is a universal sentiment across the state among school leaders. There are a couple of pieces of legislation that are upsetting educators. But first, I want to talk about the one involving tax credits and private schools. What does that bill set out to do?
Sure. That bill would create it's called a scholarship tax credit program. 18 other states actually already have similar programs that basically they incentivize folks, whether it's individuals or organizations, to donate money to private school scholarship funds, and they receive tax credits back from the state government for doing so. And, you know, one of the main criticisms of this program in other states, and it's certainly come up in the past week in Kentucky, you know, educators just call this a backdoor voucher, where inadvertently state money through tax credits winds up going to private schools.
So who's supporting this?
This bill has very strong support from Ed Choice Kentucky. This is actually an organization that has been around for several years now, mainly just to advance this legislation. They support private school choice, and here they're working on the tax credit program. It's also supported by the Catholic Conference of Kentucky. We've seen schools, mostly in the Louisville area, Catholic schools communicating out to families for them to call their state legislators and ask for support.
So why are the public schools opposed to it?
You know, I think there's a number of arguments that I've heard from public school teachers. One of them is, you know, the Kentucky Constitution makes very clear that any revenues raised by the state for educational purposes shall not be given to religious schools. And again, those folks that see this as just a backdoor voucher program, they say that violates that aspect of the Constitution. The other really, really big concern among public school teachers that feel their schools are already underfunded is that this essentially could, by the fourth year of its program, mean $50 million less in the state's general fund. And of course, we know that's where our public school funding from the state is coming from.
So I'm hearing like different viewpoints from educators and the Republicans in Frankfort on how Kentucky schools have fared lately in terms of funding. I saw multiple superintendents talk about the state being the fourth worst funded in the nation for education, but then Republican lawmakers say there's been record funding for the schools. What's the truth here?
Yeah, that has been a very big part of this whole debate across the past week, and I would say really across the past year, going back to when we had the major protests in the spring of 2018, is this really this dissonance on what is actually happening in Kentucky with public education funding. Republicans will say, hey, we working with Governor Matt Bevin's administration, we have allotted a record level of funding to per pupil. It's called SEEK funding here in Kentucky. And when you're accounting for a dollar, real dollar basis, they're correct. They're right now it's $4,000, and it's never been that high at all in the state of Kentucky. At the same time, critics and you know, the policy analysts will say, but you're not accounting for inflation. So when you factor that in, we're really looking at levels here that have not moved much since the recession, and that's where that fourth worst in the country is coming from. That Kentucky is one of the states that since the recession really has not bounced its funding back up.
So this bill related to tax credits for private schools, what's the status of that bill?
So there were two bills. The one that actually had a committee hearing, an informational hearing, House Bill 205. From my standpoint right now, to be honest with you, Michael, it looks dead as a standalone bill. It never made it out of committee, and that committee that heard it is not scheduled to meet again on Tuesday. And so I think that is its chances of making it through on its own are over. But teachers are definitely very concerned, given what happened last year here with the pension reform bill that was tacked onto what had previously been a sewage bill. They're very concerned that, you know, in the last hours of the session, that tax credit program could show up, you know, sort of tucked into the budget bill or the tax bill here.
So we've got about a minute left, and there's some concern also from educators about how the pension system for teachers is managed. What's that?
Sure. So there's one bill out there that is still alive. Speaker David Osborne did tell reporters yesterday that he thinks they're very close to getting it to a point where it is ready for a floor vote, which means it would have the legs to get to the governor's office before the end of session. That bill would restructure the board that oversees the teachers' pension system. The Kentucky Education Association, the statewide union here, is very, very opposed to it because it really dilutes their influence on the board.
So some school districts in your neck of the woods, including the state's largest, Jefferson County, have closed over some sick outs. Are the teachers upset mostly about that bill related to the pension?
I think it's the pension bill. It's the tax credit bill. We've also got a bill here that's targeted just for Jefferson County, which some teachers are worried about it affecting the voice of parents and teachers on school-based decision-making councils, which are unique to Kentucky. But I think, to be honest with you, Michael, a lot of this, it goes back to last year and that pension reform bill that came through at about 10 o'clock at night and really took everyone by surprise. And I think that sort of just represented this gigantic breach of trust between state government and Kentucky's teachers. And a lot of what I've been seeing among social media discussions with teachers, they just don't trust. They don't trust what politicians are saying to them. They, to be quite frank with you, they haven't really been trusting what I've been reporting to them. A lot of them were convinced that the legislature was going to come back into session today, even though that was not the case.
Mandy, we appreciate your time. Mandy McLaren from the Courier-Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And now big news on the gorilla front. WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner is here with that story. Welcome, Tana.
Thanks for having me.
This has been your story in New May.
I'm on the gorilla beat.
So what's the latest?
We have a target date. May 13th is the target date to bring him back to Cincinnati. Some would say bring him home. They are going to start May 18th or March 18th, the week, sending some folks from the zoo here out to sort of start, you know, interacting with him, get him acclimated. They'll do crate training. He'll be transported on a DHL plane in a crate.
Wow.
This is actually something DHL knows a few things about.
Really?
They've already done 11 transfers just for the Cincinnati Zoo, great apes. And apes and animals move around a lot. The Association of Zoos and Aquariums moves animals around a lot for mating purposes and things like that. So they have to get around somehow. So DHL apparently knows what they're doing here. So the zookeepers, what they want to do is get him comfortable with going into the crate on his own, hopefully, so that he'll be ready to for the trip. And then they're also going to do some training with him. So if he were to need to be anesthetized for the trip, if he's not down with the crate, they'll give him an injection in his hand. So they're going to start training him to be okay with having an injection in hand if he should have to have that.
So his story begins in Cincinnati.
Right.
And then he was sent off to be a companion.
Right. In 1991, he was sent to the Gorilla Foundation in California as a companion for Coco, which was the gorilla that was famous for apparently allegedly knowing how to use sign language. And as soon as he got there, she basically rejected him. But the Cincinnati Zoo said, well, he can stay on anyway because Coco shouldn't be alone. Gorillas are social animals. And then Coco died last year. And then the zoo said, well, according to the contract, you know, he needs to come home because he's all alone there. And the foundation said, well, no, we'd like to keep him and find him some other friends because right now it's a gorilla foundation without a gorilla once Ndume's gone. So, but a judge said, no, they have a contract and you have to honor it and told them to work it out. So this is the plan.
So we've got about 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. What do they expect Ndume's reaction to be upon return to the Cincinnati Zoo?
Well, he'll be quarantined for 45 days, I guess, typically thing. And then they're going to start introducing him to some female gorillas. They would like, they're social animals. They want him to live in a group with two other females. So they're going to see if that'll work.
So he has experience being seen by humans?
He hasn't been on display in a long time, so he may not end up on display.
Tana Weingartner, we appreciate your update on this story. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.